I'd like to request Mr. Pekerty to introduce our next keynote speaker. Mr. Pekerty is director of the Institute for Management, Education, and Development. This is a private interfaith institution in Jakarta, and it is supported by Muslims, Protestants, Catholics, Hindus, and Buddhists. He has worked with the Institute for the last 20 years. Dr. Pekerty has a doctorate degree on business administration from the University of Southern California. May we please ask Dr. Pekerty to introduce our next keynote speaker, Dr. Pekerty.
Mr. Chairman, Eminence, Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure for me to introduce a son of Indonesia who is closest to Australia for the reason that he was born in Maumere on the island of Flores. You see the map there. He was born on this tiny island closest to Australia. Dr. Franceda is a remarkable person. He has had a career as a politician statesman, as a businessman, as an educator, and as an educator. He was Minister of Plantations in Indonesia in the early 60s. Then he became the Minister of Agriculture. And starting in 1965, he contributed in the rebuilding of Indonesia. First as a Minister of Finance, then as a Minister of Transportation and Communication and Tourism. Dr. Seda has also proven to be an excellent ambassador of the country. He has served as the ambassador of the Republic of Indonesia to the European Community and the Kingdom of Belgium and Luxembourg. His final government appointment was as a member of the Supreme Advisory Council to the President of the Republic of Indonesia. He serves in various educational institutions. He is the founder of the Catholic University Atmajaya in Jakarta, and he serves on the board of many others. Last but not least, he is also a businessman. He is currently involved in various business ventures. He is the vice president of the Bentara Rakyat Foundation, publisher of the largest newspaper in Indonesia. He serves as the president commissioner of a joint venture company that promotes tourism to Indonesia, and the general chairman of the National Association of Textile Producers in Indonesia, member of the board of Asian Advisors of Sears Roebuck USA, member of the board of commissioner of Bayer Indonesia, and finally, also chairman of the Indonesian Netherlands Association. He is honored and distinguished because he has been conferred the Grand Cross of the Order of Silver Star from Pope Paul VI, the Grand Cross of the Kingdom of Cambodia conferred by Prince Norodom Sihanouk. He has also been conferred the Grand Cross of the University of Santo Tomas from the Philippines. And finally, he has also conferred the Bintang Mahaputra of the Republic of Indonesia, which means the Grand Cross of the Great Sons of the Republic. Today, he is going to share his thoughts and wisdom with you. and let me present you Dr. Franceda. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Your Eminence, Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, I should be more humble than His Eminence, the Cardinal. So it is asked the Congress Organizing Council has given me the privilege and opportunity today to speak or to share thoughts with you about managing business in Asia, efficient of development. It is the second time I've got the honor to be a keynote speaker in this Congress. I would like to share my thoughts with you about the role of business in human-centered development, with specific reference to the Asian context. And I would like to begin by contrasting two paradigms of development, a production-centered and a human-centered development. The dominant paradigm of most national development efforts is a production paradigm, and its dominant goals are production-centered. Its value, systems, and methods are geared to exploitation of natural resources to mass produce goods and services, and the creation of consumer society to absorb them. In such a system, societies are organized into functional, efficient production units, and these units are nationally and globally linked by a trading and financial system. Its management systems are designed to maximize rates of increases of systems input, process, and output. People and the environment are externalized. The results of development is judged primarily by indicators of throughput increases on the premise that they will automatically translate into corresponding improvement in human well-being. This paradigm has been internalized in individual value systems, institutional structures, and theoretical framework and methodologies. The production paradigm has dominated our perception, thinking, and action about development for the past few decades. It has been instrumental in producing remarkable human accomplishment, particularly in the advancement of technology and production of material wealth. However, it has not been successful in eradicating hunger and poverty, war and injustice, and enslavement of the majority of the world population. In developing countries, the application of this paradigm has created mindsets, social structures, and institutions which hamper the achievement of what I regard the three main desired values of development. Those are the preservation of life, human dignity, and freedom. Let me say a few words about these three desired values. Life is the most precious and irreplaceable human property that we all should try to preserve. No society can claim progress unless it is able to provide sufficient food, shelter, health, and safety for all its members. However, human life is meaningful only when it is lived in dignity. Dignity is guaranteed and enhanced when a society provides for all its members opportunities to have a sense of identity, pride, honor, and recognition as human beings. Human dignity is achievable when people are free. Freedom means free from enslavement by other people, by nature, by institutions, and by ideologies. But it should also mean free to achieve human progress through association and collaboration with other human beings. The full realization of these desired values requires a paradigm shift. Actors and students of development observe that a human-centered approach of development is emerging as an offspring of the production paradigm. This new paradigm, they will hope, will procreate more prosperous and equitable societies. The dominant logic of a human-centered development is balanced human ecology, and its dominant goal is human growth in terms of greater realization of human potentials. Its dominant base are the inexhaustible resources of information and creative initiative. In this paradigm, people are regarded as actors, not as objects of development. They define the goals, they control the resources, they and direct the processes affecting their lives. It favors self-organizing systems around human-scale organizations, not large bureaucracies, and self-reliant communities. Its production and consumption systems are organized with a territorial perspective, not a functional one. It also internalizes people and the environment in its production choices and performance. In fact, it makes people and the environment the foundations of its analytical process of development. If our vision of development is the human-centered paradigm, how will we manage our business in the developing countries of Asia? To answer this question, we will have to start by understanding the business context of these developing countries. In my view, the following characteristics are the main features of the developing countries of Asia, which are pertinent to managing business and human development: an entrepreneurial economy, poverty and unemployment, and undermanaged, unskilled workforce. Entrepreneurial economy. In the developing countries of Asia, we have very few really large national firms and multinationals. What we have are small and medium-sized family companies. Take Indonesia, for example. Out of 9.3 million business enterprises, only 1.46% are legally registered. The remaining are small and very small enterprises that belong to the informal sector of the economy. And what we have most are opportunities that are just waiting to be turned into reality. One can almost define a developing country as one in which too many opportunities go unexploited, undeveloped, and unrealized. Poverty and unemployment. The majority of the people are material and knowledge poor. Many are unemployed. Let me take Indonesia again as example. 20 years of centrally planned economic development have produced remarkable research in creating economic well-being and advancement in education. However, the majority of the people still live in poverty. Annual per capita income in Indonesia is around 550 United States dollar because of the depreciation of dollar. But with most of the wealth accumulated among a small percentage of the population, 35 million or 21.6% of the people still live under the poverty line. Indonesia has leapt forward in educating its people. Still, by 1985, 27% of the population have had no formal education. The majority, 60%, had primary education, and 12% had secondary education, and only 1% had university education. These statistics indicate a population still poor in terms of knowledge and skills. Many of the working age people are unemployed. Officially, according to the Central Bureau of Statistics, unemployment rate is around 2%. However, if we base the calculations on American standards, the unemployment rate runs as high as around 50%. And the labor force is growing by 2.3 million people annually. This large pool of poor and unemployed people are often regarded as a source of cheap labor that provide a comparative advantage for a developing country. this may be true if the labor force is highly productive. However, people's productivity depends on knowledge and skills. Undermanaged and unskilled workforce. One of the key success factors of development is the creative application of human knowledge, which, in practice, means mastery of technical and managerial skills. Peter Drucker, the guru of management, observes that developing countries are not underdeveloped, but undermanaged. This reasoning may explain both the case of less developed, resource-rich Indonesia and the more developed, resource-poor Japan, Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, and Hong Kong. In running business, my business, I found that I have to depend on very limited supply of skilled workers and managers. As a result, in managing the business, I have to cope with overall low workers' productivity and constant costly competition of acquiring competent workers. Hijacking of managers and executives has become quite problematical. Considering the context of developing countries of Asia, as described in the previous actions, managing a business may have to focus on the following three action modes. First, creating jobs and wealth. In developing countries of Asia, what is surely needed are not so much administrative management that optimize the use of resources, but entrepreneurial management. A management that creates jobs by exploiting opportunities and marshal resources in a new configuration to create wealth. The business manager that developing countries of Asia needs is one who can spot an opportunity, gather the requisite resources to take advantage of it, and organize a viable enterprise to capitalize on it. Subsequently, nurture the enterprise, solve its problems, and maintain its ability to respond to emerging opportunities while keeping it prosperous and productive. The person must be both an entrepreneur and a manager. The entrepreneurial manager may even have a role in training would-be entrepreneurs intentionally or inadvertently. He may want to help other entrepreneurs so that the whole industry may grow, or his company may be used as incubators by would-be entrepreneurs. Creating jobs is sustainable only if the enterprise remains productive and organizationally healthy. Third, empowering and enabling people. An enterprise is productive if its people are empowered and able. In a high unemployment situation, the workers, particularly the least skilled, have a very weak bargaining position. In such a situation, empowering workers may mean uncoupling our employees from the supply and demand mechanism of the labor market. People may accept subsistence salaries for want of any work, but managing business in a human-centered paradigm would mandate the manager to pay a decent living wage regardless of what the market dictates. Efficiency should be achieved through other economies, not by reducing human dignity. Empowering workers are also may be enhanced through ownership participation. In managing a business, frequently we have to make the choice between man and machine to improve productivity and gain a competitive edge. Most of the time, our choice made machines employed and people unemployed. In a developing society, adoption of the human-centered paradigm would suggest that we should first consider improving productivity through employing and enabling people. However, training and enabling people is costly and risky. We are never sure that the people we train will remain working for us. There is always a chance that they will leave and even work for a competitor. However, in a developing society, enabling people is a social responsibility that business cannot afford to shirk. Ignorance and incompetence are two kinds of poverty that we all should try to eradicate. Empowered and able people are necessary, but not sufficient to sustain a productive enterprise. They need to be synergized and their knowledge and experience need to be perpetuated in institutions for learning purposes. We need to build organizations, business organizations. What does it take to sustain and develop an organization in a developing society? The answer is to develop an ethical learning organization. As a member of directors, I have observed the birth and growth of two remarkable enterprises in Indonesia, the daily newspaper Kompas and the Institute for Management Education Development. The development of these two organizations embodied key characteristics of what I would call an ethical-oriented learning organization, a way of organizing that is consistent with the human-centered paradigm. Both organizations have excellent performance in the business in which they are operating. Kompas is the largest newspaper and IPPM, the largest management training institute in Indonesia. Although they operate in entirely different businesses, they have a set of common key characteristics which epitomize the ethically oriented learning organizations. The commonality includes the following characteristics. Both organizations are strongly guided by a set of shared moral values. Honesty, for example, is firmly practiced in both organizations. In applying their moral convictions, they are neither rigid nor situational. They are responsive to the environment without compromising their moral stance. Members of both organizations are keen learners and beget the satisfaction from high performance. They learn from others and their own experience. Learning implies openness and respect for others. Such an environment is conducive for people to advance and to develop to become competent high performers. In learning organizations, people are not afraid to change and to produce innovations. They are keen to try new things or ideas. However, this propensity to change is anchored in consistency of operations. They are persistent to produce the best possible products and services. Finally, members of the organizations share clear visions about their common intentions. They have clear images of what they want to be and what they want to achieve. In summary, I should say, these two organizations made their members feel that they are in control of their own destiny and that they are able to cooperate with other people to achieve results greater than what each individual can possibly achieve. Ladies and gentlemen, I've shared with you my thoughts about the human-centered vision of managing business in Asia that may enhance the preservation of life, human dignity, and freedom. The key modes of actions are creating jobs and wealth, empowering and enabling people, and building learning organizations. Thank you.
Frank Seda for his keynote speech. He had covered the basic underlying systems of values that should be present in enterprises if they are to meet the challenge of human development. He has also briefly outlined the characteristics of many developing countries, especially as it reflects itself in Indonesia, and perhaps what can be done to overcome those handicaps and those shortcomings and problems. I'd like now to call on Mr. John Ralph to introduce our next keynote speaker. John Ralph, as you all know, is the chairman of the host committee here in Australia, but also he is managing director and chief executive of the CRA Limited, one of Australia's largest diversified mining and manufacturing company. John is also chairman of Comarco Limited and deputy chairman of the Commonwealth Banking Corporation. He is a companion officer of the Order of Australia and has served as chairman of the Australian Manufacturing Council since 1984, and has chaired a couple of major government inquiries, and is active in a large range of community service organizations. So may we request Mr. Ralph to introduce our next keynote speaker, Mr. Ralph.
Chairman, the Congress Council asked that an Australian speaker, as well as our last speaker, Dr. Sader, to respond to the challenge of Cardinal Sin's address this morning. And the Council asked Mr. Brian Healy if he would do this, and we are pleased that Brian accepted that invitation. Brian is a member of the Hosting Committee. He is a Senior Vice President of the US-based multinational Sara Lee Corporation, and he is the Chief Executive Officer of Nicholas Kiwi Worldwide. And this is a division of Sara Lee. Prior to this, for 18 years, he was involved in general managing and marketing in Nabisco, and for 7 of those 18 years, he was area president for Asia and the Pacific. So he brings quite a deal of experience in the topic in which we're most interested this morning. So I have much pleasure in asking Brian Healy to address us.
Mr. Chairman, Your Eminence, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, I believe that foreign investment, and specifically Australian investment in Asia, is intrinsically good and produces a human benefit. I further believe that private investment, with all its faults and shortcomings, is the most efficient form and it is the most likely to produce the maximum people benefit. I have therefore no doubt at all that all investment has a human face, and the major issue I believe we should consider is the degree to which that human face is given support and recognition. So having told you what my position is and where I'm coming from, let me briefly tell you how I intend to use the short time available to me this morning. First of all, I should like to tell you a little about myself and my company. Following that, I should like to review the case for business investment in Asia. And then, whilst in no way resiling from my basic proposition, I should like to tell you something of our company's basic philosophy on public responsibility. And finally, I should like to address the cultural issue or issues associated with investment in Asia by Australian or European companies. Let me tell you briefly of ourselves. As John has said, I'm a Senior Vice President of the Sara Lee Corporation of the USA. This is a $10 billion Chicago-based international corporation. It is a diversified business with a number of core activities, including frozen baked goods, food services, Dow Egbert coffee, and my own area of personal and care and household products. The second hat that I wear, and the one that I think is most relevant to my talk today, is a Chief Executive of Nicholas Kiwi. The half of that name, best known to the Asian members of this audience, will undoubtedly be the Kiwi name associated with shoe care and household products throughout Asia. The Nicholas name is perhaps less well known in the region, but encompasses our OTC medicine and personal care business. Nicholas Kiwi is somewhat unique, or is unique, in being an Australian consumer goods multinational, and our involvement in Asia dates back to the 30s. And we have had a physical presence there in terms of manufacturing since 1952. We are manufacturing in India, Pakistan, Indonesia, Philippines, Thailand, Singapore, and Malaysia, and we have a physical, if not manufacturing, presence in Hong Kong and Japan. We employ approximately 2,000 people throughout the region, and whilst this is not large by the region standards, it does represent 40% of our worldwide workforce. Our businesses are a mixture of wholly owned and joint venture operations. Almost all started from nothing. That is, we did not acquire existing businesses, but built from the ground up. I think the above experience gives us, and to a lesser extent myself, some knowledge of investing and working within the region. And let me emphasize, this is at a grassroots level. Now let me return to my basic proposition, that Australian investment in Asia is intrinsically good for the people of the region. And the major and overall benefit of foreign investment is that it raises the standard.